The Russian President Vladimir Putin says he is 100% confident that Moscow will destroy advanced U.S. Patriot missiles in Ukraine. Morocco witnesses rallies in support of the Palestinian cause, with demonstrators calling for the cancellation of the normalization deal with Israel. The UN says the Taliban's ban on women working for NGOs in Afghanistan will hit humanitarian operations in the country. Thanks for joining us. The Russian president says Moscow is ready to negotiate with all other parties involved in the Ukraine war, but it is Kiev and its Western backers that refuse to engage in talks. Vladimir Putin says that Russia is moving in the right direction in Ukraine because the West, led by the U.S., is trying to tear Russia apart. He says Russia is only defending its national interests and protecting its citizens. Putin pointed to the planned U.S. delivery of the advanced Patriot missile system to Ukraine, saying that he is 100% confident that Russia will destroy the battery. The Ukraine war is the most deadly conflict in Europe since World War II, and the biggest confrontation between Moscow and the West in 60 years. Moscow says that it will keep fighting until it achieves its proclaimed goals of demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine are achieved. Meanwhile, Ukraine has announced that it will not rest until all Russian forces are driven out of its territory. Air raid sirens are sounding in the Ukrainian capital Kiev and elsewhere across the country, as the war with Russia grinds on into its 11th month. The Kiev city administrations urged people to go to shelters. Unconfirmed Ukrainian social media reports said the alert may have been declared after Russian jets took to the skies in Belarus. The sirens come after a strike on the southern city of Kherson killed at least 10 people and injured almost 60 others. Ukraine blamed Russia for the attack, but Moscow said it was a false flag operation by Kiev. Russia captured Kherson weeks after its invasion in February, but its forces recently withdrew from the city. It still controls much of Kherson region, and fierce battles continue around the city. Kherson was one of the four Ukrainian regions that Russia annexed following referendums in September. On to France, where clashes have erupted between police and protesters, one day after three people of a Kurdish community are killed in the capital, Paris. Police used tear gas to disperse the protesters who hurled rocks to vent their anger. Protesters demand answers over the killings and support and protection from the government. The gun attack happened on Friday at a Kurdish cultural center and a nearby cafe. Investigations are underway. Police have arrested a 69-year-old man. He's known to have a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially the Kurds. We asked journalist and political commentator Sam Mohsen Abbas about the way that the French police have responded to such deadly attacks. Here's what he had to say.
No, I think it's very clear. Even the French police have admitted at the moment that there's a case of racism, according to them. Of course, this is really contentious because we see this consistently with Western police services and counter-terrorism fraternity, where they are very reluctant to name white terrorists, essentially, European indigenous white terrorists, as such. They like to fob it off as people with mental disturbance cases, or they're racist, or it's a one-off incident. The fact of the matter is that Europe and the West in general is suffering from an absolute, it's an absolute pandemic of violent, right-wing organizations and actions. I mean, you only need to look across some of the internationally recognized organizations like the Atomwaffen Division. That's formed by a guy called Brandon Russell, who's responsible for multiple murders and mass casualty plots. That was across Canada and Australia. You've got others, I could name Combat 18. It's a neo-Nazi organization that's been proscribed in Canada and Germany. And of course, Nordic Resistance Movement. The list goes on and on. The most concerning one, of course, is the link to the Ukrainian Azov brigade, which is currently being backed big time by the Americans and Putin. And this raises the question of the connection between Western deep state and these terrorists.
Inflation in Germany is likely to remain high for another 2 years as companies pass on higher input costs. Head of the Council of Economists, Monika Schnitzer, says inflation is happening due to the second effect of high energy prices and some companies significantly exaggerating their input costs. She expressed concern about high electricity prices. The official stressed that the government should decide whether to let the remaining nuclear plants run in the country or not. The top economist demands ordering new fuel rods and rechargeable batteries promptly. German inflation faces its fastest pace since 1950, with a consumer price rise of 11.3% in November. The crisis is happening while European countries are grappling with increasing costs of living these days. Economist Mark Thornton joined us earlier with his take on the main cause of inflation in Germany. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The main cause is the government central banks, in particular the Federal Reserve here in the United States, and the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, and many other central banks following their lead have been printing up huge amounts of money to buy themselves out of tricky political situations. Now, when you get on a country-by-country basis, you have to look at their economies. And for example, the United States economy has lots of energy production, so our inflation rate is slightly below. But in Germany, they've become completely dependent upon outside energy sources. They've been shutting down nuclear, they've been shutting down coal-fired plants to the detriment of the German people. And so that's why their inflation rate is higher than, let's say, the global average price inflation rate. And that points to solutions that might make the situation better for Germans and other people suffering from inflation around the world. And I do predict that price inflation is not subsiding as the Germans thought last month. But it's going to reignite and go higher still and remain high for a long period of time.
Britain is bracing for fresh nationwide industrial strikes. More and more workers are going to walk off their jobs, demanding higher wages amid a cost of living crisis. Railway workers are walking off their jobs and will maintain their strike until Tuesday. The Network Rail warned of major disruptions, calling on people to travel only if necessary, as rail transportation services will be significantly reduced. Railway employees demand a pay rise proportionate to the country's soaring inflation. The railway strikes come amid widespread industry walkouts, including border force workers at airports, postal employees, nurses, and ambulance drivers, among others. The decade's high inflation rate has led to a cost of living crisis, forcing Britons to dig deeper into their pockets. Is the UK having Brexit buyer's remorse, or is the departure from the European Union delivering? Well, with the country in its longest recession on record, Britons are starting to examine the real consequences of leaving the EU. Said Puruza reports.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlies Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture. I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock. They've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Sai Purza, London.
Normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel continue to draw public anger. In Morocco, people hold protest rallies in over two dozen cities to condemn ties with the regime. The centerpiece of the protest was staged in the capital, Rabat. There, demonstrators marched on the parliament. They chanted slogans and held signs calling the deal treacherous and demanding its cancellation. They also set fire to the Israeli flag and reiterated their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. Israel and Morocco agreed to a U.S.-sponsored deal to normalize relations in December 2020. Three other Arab countries had earlier signed similar agreements with the regime. The agreements have been widely denounced by Palestinian groups and Muslim nations. Ordinary Yemenis are applauding the Yemeni government for forcing the Saudi-led coalition to release Yemeni fuel ships that were detained earlier this week. The release of the fuel ships has resulted in lower fuel prices in areas controlled by the Yemeni government. Yusuf Mowry has more from Sana'a.
Fuel prices have slightly dropped in Yemen after the release of two Yemeni fuel ships that were detained by the Saudi-led coalition earlier this week in the Red Sea. The Yemeni army issued a stern warning to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that if the ships were not released soon, military action would follow. Yemeni bus and motorbike drivers in the capital Sana'a, who make a living from public transportation, welcome the lowering of fuel prices. They say this is going to help them cope with the fuel price hike caused by the blockade.
As you can see, I am pumping 1 liter for only 500 Yemeni riyals, whereas before it used to cost us 1,500 to 2,000 for 1 liter.
The Saudi-led coalition who are seizing Yemeni fuel ships do not respond to peaceful dialogue. They only respond to us when we decide to use our military power, and if that's the case, so be it.
Yemeni political expert says the release of the fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition isn't enough, as Yemen will continue to struggle until Saudi Arabia and its allies completely lift the blockade and end their illegal involvement in Yemen.
Although the price of fuel has slightly dropped, we still need to look at the more pressing issue, and that is the fact that the Saudi-led coalition is still occupying Yemen. We need to reach an ultimate solution that can only come through taking decisive military actions against them. This is the only solution.
Despite falling oil prices, tensions are rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen for what could soon be a resumption of war if a political solution is not reached soon. This as Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue their militarization of strategic Yemeni islands in the Red and Arabian Sea.
The release of Yemeni fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition marks a big victory for the Yemeni government based in Sana'a and to the people living in the areas controlled by Ansar Allah. This also indicates that Saudi Arabia and the UAE simply cannot afford to have their oil industry targeted by Yemeni ballistic missiles, which is why they chose a safer option by releasing the fuel vessels. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
The Taliban's ban on women working for NGOs in Afghanistan draws strong condemnations from countries and international bodies. The United Nations said the move would hit humanitarian operations just as winter grips a country already in economic crisis. The UN envoy for Afghanistan said that his office would consult in NGOs and seek to meet with Taliban authorities for an explanation. Meanwhile, the EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell said the European Union strongly condemns the decision. The Taliban ordered NGOs to stop their women employees from working because of, quote, serious complaints of the non-observance of the Islamic hijab by female workers. The decision comes less than a week after it banned women from attending universities. Some 250 million people in North America are feeling the icy grip of a massive winter storm that has been linked to at least 19 deaths ahead of the holiday weekend. The last storm extends all the way from Texas to Quebec. Temperatures have dropped to minus 45 degrees Celsius in some areas. More than 1.5 million people have lost power, and over 7,000 U.S. flights have been canceled. Low visibility has caused a number of fatalities in traffic accidents, including a 50-car pileup in Ohio that has killed 4 motorists. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. Martyr Beheshti was an outstanding personage. He was truly, in all fairness, an outstanding person. From the time he came from abroad and up to the time of his martyrdom, during the years before the victory of the revolution, we were continuously working with him from up close. I witnessed that truly he was an outstanding personage. I witnessed the same thing in the organizations where we worked together. The late Ayatollah Taleghani was elected as the chairman of the Revolutionary Council. But this same council unanimously were of the opinion that he needed as a vice chairman. And Mr. Beheshti was chosen by them to be that vice chairman. Mr. Beheshti was in charge of the administration of the Revolutionary Council. even during the lifetime of the late Mr. Taliqani. He was an outstanding personage. May God exalt his rank by his grace.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I'd like to take a quick look at the situation during that time and this gathering. These events are something for us to learn from, taking into consideration the situation that existed 41 years ago on June 28th can be enlightening. First of all, in those days, the imposed war had created the worst, most difficult situation. Saddam's regime had brought its forces close to our large cities in both the south and in the west. Some of the cities they had taken control of, in some cities such as Ahvaz, Disful, and some other cities in the west of the country, their forces had come close to those cities. During the first months of the year 1360, that is 1981 AD, in April, May, and June, I was in the western region of the country. I won't forget, I mean even now, while I'm talking to you, the effect of the grief that had spread over the region at that time is still in my heart. A cloud of sorrow had spread over the whole western region. This could be seen wherever a person went.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by US Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after US military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting US military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the US and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts.
And the story also looks at the kind of hypocritical promises and pledges by Twitter. Twitter, since 2016, has promised to crack down on state-backed influence operations, to shut down covert propaganda, and they brag all the time about shutting down Russian or Venezuelan or even Thai secret Twitter accounts that are run by the military.
Azerbaijan.
Yeah, Azeris are always doing this as well. Yeah. But really, the U.S. is doing this. And Twitter, even though they promised to shut down all state-backed influence operations, they've worked hand in glove with the U.S. military, giving them special privileges for their fake Twitter accounts, these fake personalities that kind of make organic-looking conversations in Yemen or Syria or Iraq.
The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts used photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security. Others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on his platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kiev had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO. As the West, spearheaded by the U.S., continues to pour more military and economic aid packages to Ukraine, there are now calls for more transparency. In the U.S., Republicans are calling for plans to exercise oversight powers to scrutinize tens of billions of dollars that the U.S. has spent. Republicans have been more skeptical than their Democratic counterparts in the Senate about funding Ukraine's defenses. Some Republicans have cited corruption in Ukraine, saying that there are concerns about the aid going to the country. Prior to the Ukrainian president's remarks, a few Republicans had already made public their opposition to the spending bill and further aid to Ukraine. We should be focused on trying to contain the war, not expand the war. And this sends the message that we are kind of okay with expanding the war. And I think we should be sending a different message, is what Warren Davidson, a Republican congressman, has said. Another Republican congressman, Matthew Gaetz, has criticized Zelensky, saying that American politicians who indulge his requests are unwilling to put Ukraine first.
You've got Americans here at home that are demanding accountability on our southwest border. You've got crime rampant. You've got historic inflation. You have a litany of issues that we all are paying for at the behest of this administration. And no one can tell us where this money is going. My heart breaks for the Ukrainians, absolutely. But every American deserves to know where every single dollar has gone.
This comes amid a declining support of Republican voters for more military aid to Ukraine. In the latest poll, 33% of Republicans agreed with prolonged support compared to 61% of Democrats and 46% of independents.
The skyrocketing energy prices have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion, according to a new report stating that the current situation as the fallout of the war in Ukraine is just the beginning of the deepest crisis in decades. Citing its calculations based on market data, a report published in Bloomberg said $1 trillion is a broad tally of more expensive energy for consumers and companies in European countries. However, that's just the beginning. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. Even with more facilities to import liquefied natural gas coming online, the market is expected to remain tight until 2026, when additional production capacity from the US to Qatar becomes available. That means no respite from high prices. The report also referred to more than $700 billion pledged by the European Union governments to protect consumers and companies from soaring prices, noting that aid is becoming increasingly unaffordable as interest rates are rising and economies are already in recession amid the war in Ukraine. Government fiscal capacity is already stretched. About half of European Union member states have debt exceeding the bloc's limit of 60% of gross domestic product. A rush to fill storage last summer, despite near-record prices, has eased the supply squeeze for now, but freezing weather is giving Europe's energy system its first real test this winter. Last week, Germany's network regulator warned that not enough gas is being saved and two of five indicators, including consumption levels, have become critical. With supply tight, businesses and consumers have been asked to reduce usage. According to the International Energy Agency, the EU managed to curb gas demand by 50 billion cubic meters this year. But the region still faces a potential gap of 27 billion cubic meters in 2023. That assumes Russian supplies drop to zero and Chinese LNG imports return to 2021 levels. The main source of pipeline gas from Russia to Western Europe was Nord Stream, which was damaged in an act of sabotage in September. The region is still receiving a small amount of Russian supplies through Ukraine, but heavy shelling of energy infrastructure by the Kremlin puts the route at risk. Without this gas line, refilling storage will be challenging. Also, LNG imports into Europe are at record levels and new floating terminals are opening in Germany to receive the fuel. Government-backed buying has helped Europe attract cargoes away from China. But colder weather in Asia and a potentially strong economic recovery after Beijing eased COVID restrictions could make that more difficult. Chinese gas imports are likely to be 7% higher in 2023 than this year. Beijing has started securing LNG supplies for next year, putting it in direct competition with Europe for spare shipments. China isn't Europe's only problem. Other Asian countries are moving to procure more gas. Japan, the world's top LNG importer this year, is even considering setting up a strategic reserve, with the government also looking to subsidize purchases. for the likes of Germany, which rely on affordable energy to make products from cars to chemicals, high costs mean losing competitiveness to the US and China. That puts pressure on Chancellor Olaf Scholz's administration to maintain support for the economy. The challenge is finding the balance between keeping factories running and homes heated in the near term. The Kremlin has lashed out at a decision by the European Union to put a price cap on natural gas in order to supposedly deprive Russia of funds to continue the war against the neighboring Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said on Monday that the decision was an attack on market pricing mechanisms. Peskov's criticism came after EU energy ministers agreed to trigger a cap if gas prices exceed 180 euros per megawatt hour for 3 days on the Dutch tidal transfer facility gas hub's front month contract, which serves as the European benchmark. The price cap can be triggered starting from February 15, 2023. Reuters reported, citing a document detailing the final deal. Three EU officials were cited by Reuters as saying that the Netherlands and Austria abstained from voting on the decision. Both countries had resisted the cap during negotiations, fearing it could disrupt Europe's energy markets and compromise Europe's energy security. The EU officials added, Germany voted to support the deal despite having raised concerns about the policy's impact on Europe's ability to attract gas supplies in price-competitive global markets. The deal followed months of debate on the idea and two previous emergency meetings that failed to clinch an agreement among countries that disagreed on whether a price cap would help or hinder Europe's attempts to contain the energy crisis. Poland, however, welcomed the agreement, saying it would be an end to what it called market manipulation by Russia and Gazprom. Russia's war in Ukraine started in late February, with Moscow saying that it was aimed at defending the pro-Russian population in the eastern Ukrainian regions of Luhansk and Donetsk against persecution by Kyiv. The cap is also aimed at punishing Russia for cutting off most of its gas deliveries to EU countries in reaction to the sanctions that the bloc has slapped on Moscow over the war. An Israeli settler has run over two Palestinian brothers near the city of Nablus in the north of the occupied West Bank, making them the latest victims of Israeli settler crimes. According to Palestinian media, Mohammad Motair and his brother Mohannad had stopped their vehicle by the side of the road near the Zatara military checkpoint south of Nablus to fix a flat tire. It was then that an Israeli settler hit the siblings, who were traveling around with their family members at the time, and fled the scene. The victim's relatives said that 28-year-old Mohammed was killed immediately after being trampled on by the settler, while his brother, 24-year-old Mohannad, was seriously injured in the same accident and was later announced dead due to his injuries. Reacting to the atrocity, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based Hamas Palestinian Resistance Movement, said the settlers are escalating their aggression against Palestinians. He added that the formation of the new right-wing government in Israel has apparently emboldened settlers to ratchet up their crimes against Palestinians. He described the incident as a new episode in the series of, quote, Zionist terrorism under the protection of the regime's police and army, saying this crime must be answered by increasing the resistance in the West Bank. Israeli occupation soldiers and settlers have been noticeably escalating their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and other areas, in an attempt to forcibly expel Palestinians from their lands and make way for expanding Israeli settlements. Israeli forces have also been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus, where new groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 210 Palestinians, including more than 50 children, in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians since 2005, when the UN started to keep a tally of Palestinian fatalities.
The World Body says Israeli forces have shot dead 19 Palestinians, including 3 children, in different incidents across the occupied territories between November 22nd and December 11th. In addition to the killings, Israeli forces have blocked the main entrances of several villages across the West Bank, disrupting livelihoods of thousands of Palestinians. Scores of Israeli settlers, guarded by police, have stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds under the pretext of celebrating Hanukkah holiday. Earlier, the Israeli police stormed Al-Aqsa and forcibly expelled Palestinians stationed inside, paving the way for the illegal settlers to storm the compound. Israeli forces deployed heavily inside Al-Quds Old City in preparation for securing the settlers' incursions and preventing Palestinians from entering the mosque. Israeli settlers intend to storm Al-Aqsa for 8 days to celebrate the so-called Hanukkah, also known as Festival of Lights, which extends from December 18th to December 26th, as settler groups promoted the storming by announcing free transportation for its members. Israeli groups and extremist settlers had previously called for massive incursions into the holy site during the Hanukkah holidays. Hardline Israeli officials and settlers regularly storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. Settlers' incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque frequently trigger clashes that leave casualties among Palestinians. Such acts of violence even led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime in 2021, during which the regime forces killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. The movement has urged Palestinians to mobilize immediately in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The resistance movement stressed the Palestinian nation will make sure to protect the mosque under any circumstances, warning Israel of the consequences of raids on the holy site. The Jewish visitation of Al-Aqsa is permitted, but as part of a decades-old agreement between Jordan, the custodian of Islamic and Christian sites in Al-Quds, and Israel in the wake of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamati. Allah my Lord, His word Quran, His word Quran. Muhammad, Prophet, Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon, praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. You're on to IRIB English Radio, and this is the Youth Station. I am Brother Muhammad.
And I am Bita at your service.
Great to have
today,
you, Sister Bita.
We have the pleasure to be with you
from here. Likewise. Question. Tall,
yeah,
beautiful,
older,
handsome, but nice. not much of a character.
Yeah.
There we go. Now, on a serious note, a person comes for, let's say, your proposal. With all of your criteria for appearance, he's on the checklist, he's okay, tested okay. Now, when it comes to character, he's atrocious.
No, thank you. No,
there we go.
I remember.
So, let's open this up. A person with the size of a heart of, let's say, a mouse, right? How successful do you think this person would be in his social life?
It's a bit difficult for me to answer this because, you know, of a society, something wide, like in my opinion, you know. And the first thing that people, when they face you, you know, they notice is your appearance. Of course, mm-hmm. it is the appearance that you have. And when you are too ugly or too beautiful or too strange and weird, you know, the reaction of the people would be somehow strange. And I don't know whether you do agree with me or not, mm-hmm. but I think this is the fact that exists in our society, unfortunately. But let me tell you a beautiful story that we have in the history of Islam, the history of Prophet Yusuf.
Mm-hmm.
Prophet Yusuf is really beautiful, and you know, he was famous in the history for his beauty,
yeah.
but he was actually... he got into prison because of his beauty, and he came out of the prison because of his inner beauty.
Oh,
and I think
yeah.
this paradoxical
That's
content
a beautiful
is so
way of
beautiful.
Looking at it.
Yeah.
Yes, that is true. Prophet Yusuf, when he was when he went to the prison, he was welcomed in the prison because of his beauty.
Exactly.
And he was put into prison by people who really envied his beauty. But then, at the end, when he was returning back from the prison, it's because of something that was really of his character, not necessarily of his
appearance. These beautiful things won't actually delete the fact that we notice to the experience of people more than to the appearance of people more than their behavior, unfortunately.
Let me tell you one thing, though.
Yeah.
Parents, let's open this discussion up from this parent side first, right?
Yeah.
A person's appearance. To be honest, don't you think that really reflects his character to a great extent? Because
yeah.
I know people, at least I can tell you from Emil's perspective, and you'll be able to easily, kind of find manifestations of this in your life. You might have male classmates and stuff. Males are generally, with regards to their attire and the way they're organized, they're very weak than females, right?
Yeah.
When you look at a person who is a mess in his studies and also in his appearance, he wears, you know, unclean clothing and stuff. Don't you think that really reflects his character?
Yeah, it actually is. You know, but, you know, sometimes you're talking about the outer beauty of, you know, natural creation, you know,
mm-hmm.
and not only clothes or, I don't know, makeup or something. No,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about the, I don't know, face of that person, the color of skin, I don't know, the hairstyle, the eye color and so on, the
mm-hmm.
things that we cannot change easily.
Mm-hmm. So those things that are natural, I think you're saying that should not be considered when you're trying to choose a person.
Exactly.
As a life partner or as anything.
Anything.
In life.
Any communication uh-huh. in everyday
yeah,
life.
Yeah, that is actually true.
But, you know, there are many people that change their appearances by, I don't know, cosmetic surgeries and so on. And I think it's heartbreaking
mm-hmm.
when you hear someone will, I don't know, go through a surgery, which is, you know, has this risk of death or anything for just being more beautiful. You know, what are your standards of beauty?
Mm-hmm. Those people, unfortunately, I would stay on your side in this because... to be, from a very optimistic perspective, everybody is beautiful in their own sense. And it's the problem with how sometimes society or ourselves conceive as beauty. Sometimes we say white skin is beauty. Sometimes the otherwise, some say black
yeah.
skin is the beauty. And if you look at some of the examples in the history, Michael Jackson, he was originally black, but he changed himself. He changed it. He did surgery and he changed himself to white. Why was that? It is because he saw, I don't know if was he uncomfortable or was there any other motivation? But changing the appearance itself shows that he or she is not satisfied about the appearance
of
the
they are. Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's go for a break.
Sure, definitely.
Sorry for interruption. So let's keep it a cliffhanger, then we're going to come back. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Youth Station. You're on to IRIB English Radio, and we are here with Sister Vita, myself,
yeah.
Muhammad, and we were talking about a very beautiful topic, appearance versus character. And we had some very beautiful discussions lately, and I think we should start this portion of the program with another question. There are a few, social... discriminative concepts, or rather...
You're talking about body shame.
Yeah, not necessarily. No, I'm talking about looking at different races from a different perspective.
You know, when you look at someone who is different, you will react different. I think this is natural to some extent. Yeah. But you have to control it. I mean, you have to control your judgment.
I'm not just talking about reaction. I'm talking about you choosing that person to be your colleague, friend, or your partner.
No, I don't care about partner is another story about marriage or something. I won't risk my...
When you talk about partners, now I remember a story from the Noble Prophet. It's a very famous story of Juwaybir.
Yeah.
When one of the African slaves, he was unmarried for a long time. And so the Prophet approached him and he said, why don't you get married? He said, look, who's going to marry me in this Arabian Peninsula? Like, I'm an African slave.
Yeah.
And then he says, look, go to XYZ address. And get, and that was actually one of probably one of the beautiful Arabian daughters. And also one of the richest ones. So he went, and as soon as the father of this daughter sees Juwaybir, he says, look, you were mistaken over here. Just go away.
Yeah.
Right? I think that also affects when choosing your life partner as well. Yeah, how you look at people. Let's say if the entire world is filled with people, beautiful parents, but then there is only this one person with atrocious parents, but with great character. Would you still go for that person? On a serious note, I'm talking about.
It is really
because you said it's important. Because you just said it's important for you.
Yeah,
so if it's important, to be honest, like it's important for me as well. It's natural because every person not only kind of sees the character and the personality of the person he chooses to make friends with in the lowest level and gets married to in the highest level, but also looks at their parents because you're going to have to stay with that person for a long time, isn't it? So in the criteria, yes, of course, I'd put like for example, beauty that reflects something that I like. I'd accept that. But when it comes to, for example, making it a deciding factor, if I have two persons with both with a different appearance, one with less attractive, one more attractive for me personally, but then the one with a less attractive person, would I still go for the character, has better character? Would I still go for that person or would I go for a more attractive person?
And actually, it depends on the extent that they are less and more, how much the beauty gap is between these two people. But the thing is, at first sight or superficial communication that I have, actually, I do care about beauty. I do care about appearance or something. But after a long time, even we don't see people, we don't look at them. You don't look at how, they are dressed up or, I don't know, what kind of hairstyle they have or something. We are talking to them. We are contacting with their souls, with their characters, with the way they think, with the way they speak, and so on. And I think for long-term relationships, I don't know, marriage, I don't know, best friends and everything, I would prefer the behavior part, you know.
Oh, that is true. When you were saying this, I remember this hadith of the Noble Prophet.
Yeah.
He says that a person who gets married because of wealth or beauty will find neither wealth or beauty because these two things are kind of temporary, to be honest. Temporary.
Exactly.
It can be, for example, let's say you're beautiful for how long are you going to be beautiful?
Yeah.
Like you're going to be beautiful until you're 60, 70, right? And then you lost your beauty. And you lost how long are you going to sustain your wealth, right? You're eventually going to lose that wealth. Now, if that person got married, God forbid, if a person gets married because and only because of wealth, it's not a problem if the person has a good character and beauty and he gets married to that person. It's fine. But if you are a person with only beauty, without any character, after a while, you're going to be essentially in a very big issue, family issues. Why?
Yeah.
Because that beauty is going to somehow go away. And the more, especially in terms of family life, the more you're living with that person, the more you get used to it, right? The beauty and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't see that
it doesn't become
at
important.
All.
Yeah. It's just the first look and that first few days that is very, oh my God, that is, I can't believe. But then after a while, I think you become used to it. And when you become used to it, that beauty part isn't important anymore. It's the character that really stays.
Exactly.
That is the glue that sticks to
it. But it doesn't mean that I don't consider beauty in my choices.
Yeah, that is true. Like, so the conclusion we can make from this specifically
First of all, let differentiate beauty. The natural beauty that you have or you don't have with it, I don't know, being beautiful in appearance. You know, there is a difference here. You know, you have to be healthy, you have to be neat, you have to be whatever. But when it is out of your control, it's another story.
Let's say natural beauty. Let's keep the point, that let's keep the base on the natural beauty.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
With regards to this same topic, I remember there is a very beautiful love story of Dr. Shamran.
I remember the first
wife he had a lot of difficulties, and she left him, apparently. But the second wife, while he was in Lebanon and he was trying to work with the resistance forces, the Hezbollah, and I remember that he got married to his wife, the Lebanese one. And one of her wife's friends, they were discussing something about her parents, and she said that, Dr. Chamran's wife said that she hates bald-headed people.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, the friend is like, really, you hate? Well, so why is your husband bald-headed? And she was like denying with all her existence, like, no, he's not bald-headed. Dr. Chamran is not bald-headed.
She didn't even notice.
Yeah. And remember, if you look at, there are many books that are translated about Dr. Chamran. I can't remember what is the title of this book I read. It was very beautiful. It talked only about his family life.
Yeah.
And how his wife got to know him. So his wife, they had encountered each other many times before marriage. And the funny thing is, from the first time she encountered him until they got married, and even many years after marriage, she didn't realize that he was bald-headed until she confronted him and they saw him, oh, you're really bald-headed.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. I think, so the take from this story is that characters can blind you. Blind you from appearance.
And
if you have a very commendable character, then your appearance doesn't matter.
And even, I think we experience in our day-to-day life these kind of situation. We have a lot of, I don't know, communication and relation in virtual world that we don't see each other's face, but we are interested in our characteristics,
that's true.
Behavior, and so on. And I think this is a beautiful story that we can tell to anyone in virtual world that you're existing in modern world. You are interacting with the soul of the people, not their appearance, not their body.
Even we have in the history that Aristotle himself, he was apparently a big-nosed face person. But then you'll find him so much revered in the history because of his character. People never saw his big nose, but they saw his character.
Yeah.
And they loved him because of the character. They loved his knowledge in academics. And I think, let's get to conclusion of all this discussion. First point, deciding factor is the character.
Nice.
But other factors such as beauty really are to be considered when you're trying to make friends. Appearance is very important, especially natural appearance, if you want to become a life partner of a person because you're going to live with that person. But further than that, if that person is of a character that is commendable by everyone, that is of a high status, then definitely that character will blind your beauty.
So let me tell you a gist of this discussion too. You know, beauty is an achievement. You can achieve it because the inner beauty is the point that will make you beautiful.
That is true.
Yeah. That is true. So we're going to end this beautiful discussion. I really don't want to do that. So that was all that time we had for today's episode. I wish you a beautiful day as your beautiful hearts. Thank you for listening to us. والسلام عليكم
ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens and break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, the UK's Office for National Statistics has released the data gathered as part of the national census, the results of which has startled many with clear proof that Britain is experiencing great change, with Islam and non-religious identities on the rise and Christianity in clear retreat. Many are asking if Britain can ever truly be considered a Christian country again.
Britain is changing. According to a 10-yearly census carried out in 2021, the United Kingdom has witnessed a seismic change in its religious and ethnic communities, with a sharp decline in British Christianity identity and a rapid growth of the Muslim population. For the first time ever, fewer than half of people in England and Wales describe themselves as Christian, just 46.2%, down from 59.3% in the last census in 2011. No religion was the second most common response after Christian. While the Muslim